What's up, Crypt Nation? Pizza Mind here with my trusted compadre, as always, Bryce Paul.
Shalom.
And we have a very special episode of Crypto 101 today. Today we are doing a special Founder Series episode, and we have on with us Will Martino and Stuart Popejoy, the co-founders of Kadena. Now, what makes this really interesting is we've been talking a lot about smart money lately. These guys work for some of the smartest money in the world, JP Morgan, but they left to come join this industry. So
smart guys leaving a failing industry with failing companies, like, makes sense to me.
Yeah. Well, you know, they saw the writing on the wall. We want to know a little bit about what that writing on the wall was, and then we want to know what they're going to be scripting next. So, Will, Stuart, welcome to Crypto 101.
Thanks. Great to be here.
Yeah, thanks, Ryan.
And we're just cheeky with JP Morgan. We mean them no disrespect. I will say one funny story that happened to me this past weekend where I went to Chase Bank to open up a new checking account. And I go in there, you know, there's about 10 employees there, you know, and they said nobody, you know, like, you can't open up a bank account today because nobody here is able to open up a bank account for you. I'm like, what do you mean? They're just like, oh, well, these are all tellers and these are our associate bankers. We only have like a manager in every couple hours or something. So I thought that was very odd that, like, you'd think that you would at all times have somebody at the bank who could open up new accounts because that's how they make money, right? They want my $100 so they could loan that out and make some good money. But it was just very odd, very, very mismanaged. And yeah, like Pizza Mind said, we've got to know.
It's not your fault, guys.
we definitely do want to know, like, before we even get into you guys personally or Kadena exactly, like Pizza Mind said, the writing on the wall, like, paint us a picture of why you guys, you know, left where you were.
Sure. I mean, this is Stuart. I'll take that because I was at JP Morgan longer than Will was. And originally I was building algorithmic trading systems for them in equities and equities derivatives. And so these are, you know, huge trading systems that handle, you know, 600 million shares a day of volume. And, you know, and if something goes wrong in those systems, you know, it's not uncommon for us to, even if it's not our fault at JP Morgan, it wouldn't be uncommon that even if it wasn't their fault, if there was some kind of error with the trade, we just take care of clients to the tune of like $500,000. You know,
whoa.
I'm just saying the level of service is, it was a service desk and like the level of service is quite high. So I left that to form the blockchain group. And started working with banking at that point because the trading was under the JP Morgan investment bank corporate. And once I got to the bank, there was a very different culture. You know, the technology was much older, things moved a lot slower, and banking was really the focus of the work on blockchain. There was no real interest from trading, just because frankly, the volumes aren't there for a bank of JP Morgan size, investment bank of JP Morgan size to even be really looking at crypto. So that was interesting already because I was dealing with very much a different culture as it was. And I think that has a lot to do with the kinds of culture things that made us, that would eventually make us want to break out and, you know, inform Kadena because while when I was working in trading, you know, there'd be a lot of like interaction with small vendors, people providing market data, all this kind of stuff. In banking, it's all about dealing with these vendors you've dealt with for a million years. And so generally slow moving, kind of conservative, and it was hard to get them to kind of put the JP Morgan name behind blockchain efforts. We open sourced the first version of our private blockchain there. And couldn't even get them to do a press release about it because, you know, they didn't want to risk associating the JP Morgan brand with some unproven technology, which is their choice. But go ahead.
I was just saying that's really silly.
It is, but it's just, they didn't really know what they were getting into. They were more interested in the strategic investment side of things. Frankly, they wanted to make sure that like interbank blockchain projects, they would be a part of. so that they wouldn't be left out. And, you know, and they wanted a feather in their cap surrounding, like, and I do think that by us leaving, we sent the message that if you want your team to, you know, if you want to retain a team that's also, you know, because the whole, it's the usual thing where you want to retain quality technologists to evaluate tech. And the way you keep quality technologists is you keep them working on interesting things. We could probably take some of the credit for why they did get their act together with Quorum, because that was part of the same group that we were in. And they stayed and we left, and they were able to, you know, in about a year's time, they were able to put all the things together that we couldn't get JP to do, like make a JP Morgan GitHub, put out press releases, and let the JP Morgan brand be more directly associated with it. But that's at our time, yeah.
As soon as you break up, that's when they finally stop drinking, clean up, sober up, get their act together.
Exactly.
So how did you guys first meet? Like, you're at JP Morgan, you're working at the blockchain center. You know, Will walks up to Stuart one day and says, hey, I'm the new guy here, or what's the story?
So Stu hired me. Was it 5 years ago, 6 years ago at this point?
What was the most challenging interview question he asked you?
The interview there was not very difficult, to be very honest. I think the most challenging technical question that I got was not from Stu. Stu and I had a different conversation where we just nerded out about Haskell, and it was clear that we were of the same mind. I had a friend who's still there, Carter Schoenwald, who I knew in college, and he's on like the Haskell committee. He's been in Haskell, which is this research language that I was interested in getting a job in. And I was coming out of the SEC, where I was just tired of being in the government because the government is so bureaucratic. So I talked to my friend Carter. Carter was the first person that Stuart hired, and went in for the interview. And Stuart and I got along very quickly. I had code to show him, and you know, code talks, so that makes it fast. I think from the other people who were there, the hardest question that I got, and these are not people who are on our desk; these are people who are in different parts of this larger group. The hardest question was something about SQL. I think it was like a group buy versus a sort question, which doesn't even really make that much sense. It was like having versus group by or something along those lines. And it was just this incredibly silly question that was the technical quote unquote like question that was supposed to be hard. Anyway, I was a second hire on this group. And I think that the thing that, you know, got me the interview was that people were expecting me to be a certain way, because Haskell engineers, like Stu and I are like one class of Haskell engineer, and then Carter's this other class of this very like intellectual, like very God brain, like focused on really big picture things, but isn't as focused as on like producing things on like a day-to-day basis. Like Haskell teams make this really good combo when you have like a few of the people who are really focused on the big picture design, and then a bunch of people who are focused on just getting stuff out the door really quickly. And I was the first person after Carter that they had met who was, you know, not Stuart ED level, who came in, and people were just like, wow, okay, like I think we can actually do something with this person. Also, my SEC background definitely helped. So, yeah, it was cool working there. We worked on some stuff before blockchain, before it became the blockchain group, and we built JP Morgan's first blockchain and open sourced it. I just don't think JP Morgan was really, and back to what Stu said, they weren't really focused on having that group build the highest performance private blockchain 4 years ago. And Juno is still one of the fastest private blockchains out there. I think it can do about 1,000 transactions a second and scale up to something like 60 or 80 nodes, which is still lightning compared to most of the things like R3 or IBM bring to the table, even though it hasn't been worked on for 4 years and it's just sitting there open sourced. So they didn't really expect us to build a world-class private chain and didn't really know what to do with it. And then, as Stu mentioned, we left, and that was pretty much a wake-up call that, hey, there's something special going on in this group. If you want to keep the people and really go and make a brand around JP Morgan and blockchain, you need to get more, you know, open and aggressive with doing press around it, because otherwise these people are probably going to leave, because they're seeing the questions that we gathered all these questions that we knew needed to be answered, and we had a line of sight of how to answer them so that we could take the technology forward in the 2020s.
Okay. Very cool. Very cool. I love that story. One of the other things I wanted to mention before we dove in on some other stuff was about Stuart Haber, who is, you guys are, he's one of your guys' advisors for the project. But interestingly enough, he was also one of the very few cryptographers that were cited in the Bitcoin white paper that Satoshi Nakamoto wrote. So yeah, tell us about how you guys met Stuart and how he's involved in the project.
Sure. We met, so there's been this Bitcoin NYC meetup a long time run by a guy named Jonathan Mohan. And one of the first ones I went to, it was about an Ethereum attack that had just happened. And I know quite a bit about the Ethereum virtual machine because one of our versions of our blockchain at JP Morgan actually ran EVM smart contracts. So we had built that and before we decided that EVM wasn't the right choice, which would eventually lead to us creating PACT, our smart contract language that we use in our blockchain. There's a lot of people at the meetup, but it started kind of narrowing down to a few people. And one of the other person who talked was this slightly older gentleman than me who, was saying some pretty smart things. And Jonathan introduced me afterwards and he's like, oh, this is Stuart Haber. And he's cited in the Bitcoin paper. And I was like, that's cool. nice to meet you. And that was, I want to say that was in early 2018 or late 2017. And it was just really fun to talk to him and get him involved because he really, I think he's a very practical minded person. And a lot of the stuff he did was very much focused on using cryptography, not, necessarily coming up with whizzy new technologies as much as really investigating the technology, real engineering, focusing on the technologies that are there. I mean, I don't know if you know this, but Stuart Haber has been running a blockchain, or he started a company that is still running a blockchain since 1996. It's just the way they timestamp is they publish the hash in the New York Times every Sunday. So when you read the Satoshi paper, it starts off saying, well, wouldn't it be better if we could do something instead of, say, publishing a classified in the New York Times? That's not a metaphor. He's talking about Stuart Haber's business. Mm-hmm. And it is a blockchain and it is still running. It just the consensus is the New York Times.
That's so interesting.
Yeah, it was for document. It was basically largely for legal. So it was a way to prove that a document existed. So they just hashed the document and then put it in a chain. And then every week, the root of the chain. So you could think of a week as a block.
I did not know that. That's actually a really cool and very practical application.
Definitely.
So you two are two of the smartest guys we've ever had on the podcast. We know that from talking with Will in our previous episode where we did the deep dive on the tech behind Kadena. So I wanted to ask you guys, what's the hardest part about getting through the first year of running your own business? Because no matter how smart you are, you're going to get hit with some stuff out of nowhere that's going to leave you a little dizzy.
I think for us, it's funny because I think a challenge was is that we, business development was a challenge. We went out the gate with a fair amount of fanfare. We got press, a lot of people, VCs introduced themselves to us. We got, we were able to go into a lot of banks and present our technology. But the thing is about enterprise is that the sales cycle is just incredibly long. So, we'd have all these great conversations and then they'd be like, yeah, we're going to bring you in. And then 3 months would go by before they actually brought us in. Our first paying client was Humana, and that actually happened pretty quickly, where we met at a conference in January, and I think we had a signed contract by April. So that was a very speedy thing. But so once we had that going, a lot of what we were doing at that point was just kind of heads down, getting the, polishing up our tech and making sure it was production ready. And then starting to work with our first client. So I actually feel like the biggest challenges we faced were really when we went into starting to issue SAFs for our first and our second coin sale. Because that's when we really ran into the East Coast, West Coast divide. you know, that the way the business cultures operate and act, you know, in the East Coast, people would meet us and they'd look at our background and they'd see our tech and they'd be like, right, you guys know what you're doing and you know how to build this stuff, which is clear from your background. We'd go to the West Coast and none of that applied. And it would be all about who you know, or, you know, what crypto influencers thought of you. And it's not that they weren't receptive to listen to the technology. It was just a far more insidery scene than I expected crypto to be. I expected crypto to be a little bit more open-minded. And by that time, the ICO thing had been going on quite a bit. So I think we learned some very interesting lessons about how this crypto world really works, at least in this country. But, you know, eventually we succeeded and had a good raise, especially our second raise. But our first year was pretty fun because it was just Will and I sitting at our desks, you know, working remotely and, you know, working with Humana, working with some other clients. And, you know, and seeing that the technology really did what it said. So it's kind of like the rubber hit the road maybe a little later in that.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense.
One of the biggest things we ran into early was once we started working on public chains. And when we went out to the West Coast to do our first SAF round, like, we still have to spend a lot of time talking to people about proof of work versus proof of stake. And the number of people who are just uninterested in, who, like, there's this line in the community ever since probably 2015 that proof of stake is the only future. It will be, you know, it will be the savior of crypto. We will be able to scale it. It will be faster, better, stronger. And we're still waiting 5 years later for anything sharded to come out of the proof of stake community. And Stu and I are out there in 2018, talking about, hey, we figured out a way to do sharding with proof of work. And it's really simple. And everyone I've talked to, including Stuart Haber, the guy who's the most cited person in the Satoshi white paper, you know, says, like, hey, this is going to work. Like, this thing actually does make sense. So we spent an inordinate amount of time. That was just really difficult. And it still is. People hear proof of work and they say, oh, it's antiquated technology. And then we point them to our block explorer and we say, guys, we got 10 chains sharded with sharded state running in parallel. It's been running since November. And yeah, I get that you haven't heard of us. So you'd like think that it's not a, like, you think that there's something weird here, but it's just that the entire community has been fed this line about proof of stake. And lo and behold, the first sharded system to ever see production is proof of work. We've been saying the same thing for 3 or 4 years. So that was definitely, like, early on, that was hard. And I think the other hard part was just, you know, Stuart and I are technical co-founders. So there, we didn't have the business guy on day one who came in with the Rolodex to, you know, go and build up these contracts and also to go and build the business. I've stepped more into the businessy role and Stu stepped more into the focus on tech, but we still, like, have each other's backs on everything. We still swap around all the time. So, like, figuring out that and how it goes from just two guys, like, in our, like, respective apartments, working remotely, building out the tech, going to some conferences, you know, speaking at the first Stanford blockchain conference, to we got a team of 25 that is very quickly building the most innovative platform ever to see the light of day to launch in, you know, 2019, 2020, it was just a lot really fast, but we pulled it off and it worked.
That's awesome. Tell me about something that you guys do that's, you know, really special, that is something that motivates you guys to just get up in the morning and, you know, build these businesses. What's one thing, if you could kind of boil it down to?
I think one of the things that motivates me the most is just our public network, Chainlab. Like, this is just, it's just a very cool piece of tech. Like, that's, you know, the shorter term. The longer term is definitely what Stuart's done with Pact. Pact is just this, it's like, I have enough of a background in you know, distributed systems and in SQL and databases to know a standard when I see one. And Pact is going to be the standard for smart contracts. It has everything that everyone's talked about for the last 5 years of wanting. And then a bunch of other stuff that people don't even realize they want. Things like, you know, naming services, like you get on Ethereum or Bitcoin. You just don't need them with Pact. Because you can just have an account that has a name. Maybe you can have a coin or you have a contract that has an ETH. There's a bunch of stuff in there, but it's really like PAX has this huge potential to both expand the crypto market and to bring in, to make smart contracts easier. So all of a sudden we can have programmable money. But you know, going, circling back to Chainlink briefly, I wasn't a big believer in crypto before Ethereum, I'll be honest. When I was at the SEC, I looked at Bitcoin, saw that it could do 5 transactions a second, saw that it claimed to be digital cash, and just kind of threw up my hands and said, these guys don't understand how finance works. You can't be digital cash at that throughput. And I maintain that. Even with Lightning and you know, these other layer two approaches, if your layer one can't scale beyond 5 or 10 transactions a second, you can never be digital cash. You can be digital gold, which Ethereum has become and is amazing and numerical. But Chainweb allows us to talk about, and Kana Mainnet allows us to talk about actually scaling a layer one and having real digital cash. And that's just something you don't see very often in human history. We've changed fundamentally what it means to have cash and to have money and use it on a very rare occasion, only a few times.
Today's show is brought to you by our new sponsor, Cog Network. Cog Network, geared for gain.
Cog Network is hedge fund investing evolved.
By owning Cog Network tokens, you get exposure to the hedge fund's gains. The hedge fund is comprised of algorithmically traded commodity futures and investment in hard assets related to energy. The first hard asset is partial ownership of a multi-million-dollar solar farm that has a crypto mining operation attached.
I mean, this is really something that both traditional and crypto investors can come together and participate in. So for traditional investors, they can get exposure to cutting-edge blockchain technology in a framework that they're familiar with, a hedge fund, right? And crypto investors can get exposure to an actual security that bears dividends and includes non-crypto assets.
So that's super cool. And just for full disclosure, Cog Network is a fully registered and regulated entity qualified by the SEC as a Reg D as well as a Reg S and has a 506C exemption. They've been working with lawmakers since 2017 to get this idea built out in a fully compliant way.
Crypt Nation, if you guys are interested in learning more about a tokenized hedge fund, go visit www.cog.network.
Yeah, absolutely. So what is your guys' strategy going forward now that you've just got your token listed for the very first time on Bittrex Global? And what's the campaign now to build a community of developers around this amazing product that you've built?
Well, our belief is we don't, there was a playbook that we were trying out for a while that was going around a lot in 2018 about, like, you know, that the community is everything and you gotta, you know, you gotta have somebody like Vitalik on the plane, you know, 250 days out of the year, showing up at every conference imaginable and every hackathon imaginable. And, you know, and you got to set up in Asia, Europe, United States, Latin America. And that's just critical. That's what you got to do. And what we found was that that is a bit of, I think that was a bit of ICO fluffery, you know, that that wasn't what was really going on with various coins doing well or not doing well, or, you know, going up and going down. And really what makes a community happen is basically delivering technology to the users on time that works, and then putting it in their hands and then helping them use it. You know, which Ethereum did, of course. Ethereum launched, you know, quite a long time ago, and they launched with, you know, more or less the system that they have now. And therefore, people are able to start building with it. And that's really important. And, but we've seen the same thing where, you know, we launched our blockchain in November without transfers, but with mining. We did the full launch in January, which then enabled all of the smart contracts. And since then, we see more and more interest. Before then, it was, the main interest people had was in mining, you know, and that started, you know, the mining rate started to pick up early on, and that built our community. But, it, you know, that was a mining-focused community that kind of grew our Discord, too. And now that the full platform is there, and with some of the announcements we've made, like, you know, that we're integrating with Chainlink and some of our partners, people are finally starting to get the message about PAC. Because the funny thing about smart contracts is that, you know, it's hard to get people excited about a language. It's hard to get people excited about an SDK. But when developers actually get their hands on it, they start getting pretty excited because, you know, one of the we have endless stories, user stories now about people who, you know, it'd take them 2 months to get productive in Solidity. They get a demo done in 2 weeks in Pact, and they've never even seen it before. And so people get excited about that kind of stuff because it's empowering to be able to make, you know, your POC or your concept come to life on a blockchain with so little effort. And also because Pact is such a safe language, know that it's going to be a pretty safe application right out the gate. You know, we had a really interesting thing recently with Blend, with their FinPrint company, where they migrated an entire working demo off of Ethereum onto Kadena and were able to show it to their client in 3 weeks. And it was a really slick demo too. So they put out a really nice blog article about migrating from Ethereum to Pact. So we're really excited about that. But also we're going to scale our blockchain in July from 10 chains to 20 chains. This has never been done before. You know, I mean, no one started a base layer blockchain before anyways, but this is very important for us to show that it's not just that it's sharded, it's scalably sharded. We can keep increasing the size of the network. And, you know, and that's something that has interested everybody from developers to like the enterprise blockchain press. They picked that up in our last announcement. So all in all, with that in the listing, it's a really exciting time right now, just because I think people are finally starting to really have a glimpse of what we're offering.
Man, that is amazing. Could you give me like an example? Maybe each of you give me one example of how like a Pact smart contract can either change business or government or maybe consumer habits?
Sure. I got a few of them. I'll keep them short. One thing to revisit is what Sue just talked about, which is scaling from 10 to 20 chains. You know, we have a sharded network. This is a sharded state network. When you heard the press about what Ethereum 2.0 is going to be, where it's going to have throughput, it's going to be horizontally scaled. That's what we're talking about. And we're the first people to actually get it into production. The closest competitors we have are Near, and Near hopefully will get through their 6-stage launch this year. But sharding in production is hard. Proof of stake is hard. Doing both at the same time, I don't know if it's actually possible. But we did it with proof of work. So when you start thinking about applications on top and using smart contracts on top of a sharded base layer, you can actually start, you don't have to worry about the problems that you get with something like Ethereum, where now people in Ethereum are proposing that they're going to change the gas model because the people were talking about how the rent was too damn high, now the gas is too damn high in Ethereum, and people can't actually run apps. So we don't have that problem. The way you solve the gas being expensive problem is you have a system that can scale to a network that is larger than the throughput that your users demand. So all of a sudden, you can start thinking about, instead of having layer one and two hybrid applications, which makes sense for really large scale or very privacy focused things, you can actually think about having large scale decentralized autonomous organizations or just entire applications running on a public network. But you know, when you're also talking about things like, let's say, talk about games. One of the problems that historically dApps have had is that for you as a user to go use a dApp, you need to have a crypto wallet that has cryptocurrency in it to go and start using that dApp, because you need to send in the transactions to pay the fees. And it is just this critical user experience problem. Ethereum has talked about solving it for years. Like, they've talked about pretty much everything. They've come up with every idea. They've just solved very few of them. Smart contracts are killer, but then after that, there's a bunch of UX things. And this gas problem is one of them. They talk about these things called gas stations. Well, Pact actually brings those to the table. We can have a smart contract that can actually pay for its users' gas. It's technical and exactly how this works, but the effect of it is that you could go and deploy an application like a decentralized Google Forms and go and pass that around to your friends because you want to go and collect some information, but you don't want to trust Google to not give that information to, you know, some advertiser or some third party. So you can go and do an encrypted Google Forms like app where no one who's actually filling out the form, even though there are transactions taking place on layer one, on the actual Kadena blockchain, the people who are doing the transactions aren't paying the gas. The person who built the smart contract has given the smart contract coins that it uses to pay for gas. And those coins can only be used for gas for that contract. It's a total sea change, I mean, from a UX point of view, for how we think about dApps, because no longer are you going to have to convince people, hey, to go and use CryptoKitties, you're going to need to go make a wallet first. No, instead, you can just have the app and it can make you a very lightweight wallet just inside of CryptoKitties, and the app itself, like the dApp itself on chain, can pay the gas. And that's a big one. Stu, do you have one that you want to dig into?
I mean, it's just funny because I can't actually stop talking about gas stations. We've been hearing for 3 years now how this is the number one UX issue that prevents mom and pop or grandma from getting on a crypto thing, a dApp, because it's hard enough to do crypto. And now you need to think about the ETH token as well as the token of the wallet and or of the app. And, you know, and you got to like fiddle with a wallet and you have to do all this stuff. Whereas, you know, you get to the point where gas is taken care of and then people just open up a mobile app, hit a button, and they're just going. It's just a completely different experience. And it's one of the things that it relates to one of the things about Pact, which is that Pact from the ground up was multi-sig. And that seems like no big deal. But I one of the things that I designed into the language is that I said, if you're ever going to use a key, I'm not even going to let you prevent somebody from using a key set. So you can't force a key to be single sig. It has to be at least one sig, but it can be two, it can be three, it can be best, you know, it can be two out of five, it can be any of these things. And then just use it everywhere. So that contract governance, you want to control who, we can upgrade smart contracts in Cardano, which is something you can't do in Ethereum. And that's controlled by a key set. Second, you know, anything that has to do with ownership and permissions in the dApp, why does that just have to be one key set? You might want to say three people. Any one of these three people are empowered to do this particular thing. And then when you get, but that's multi-sig when you think about like three people owning one thing. The other thing about multi-sig is making it easy to have signatures on a transaction be responsible for different things. So you have one signature that's responsible for gas, and you have one signature that's responsible for the money that you might be transacting or something like that. That is such a fundamental change to how Bitcoin and Ethereum works that makes so many things possible. But I do come back to gas stations a lot because the fundamental act of being able to, if you send a transaction into Ethereum, the most important signature on that, the one that's built into the protocol is the sender and the person paying for gas. And so the idea that now you can make that something that's actually an autonomous paying vehicle or something like that, I think is a really beautiful illustration of it. But another thing is safer custody. I mean, we're going to get to a place where you don't even have to like back up your keys anymore because you're going to have a key on your secure enclave on your Mac. You're going to have a key in your secure enclave on your iPhone. You're going to have, you know, they're just going to be kind of naturally spread out, but also tremendously secure. So things like, you know, carrying around a ledger, you know, you could have one key on a YubiKey or something like that too. And that way, you're secure and you can't lose your keys. And you just get out of this nightmare that people are in right now, where it's so easy to lose crypto.
That is a nightmare, and you highlighted it so well. I love these use cases. It's just absolutely amazing. Okay, I want to talk more about that for the next 3 hours, but we have to move on to the next topic, unfortunately. But this is the number one problem in business, and there's a lot of people out there that are running their own business. They can relate. It's finding good people to hire. How do you guys find good people, and what is your criteria for grading job candidates?
That is such a critical question and great one. We have the end of the story is that there is a book called Who, the A Method for Hiring, and it is a playbook for how you do sourcing and interviewing and converting someone over after you've made an offer and they've accepted. We live by that playbook. It got recommended to me by the people. The backstory of how we found it was we were talking with the people at A Capital.
What's the name of it again, real quick?
It's Who : the A Method for Hiring, I believe. It's just fantastic. It has this thing called the top grading interview in it, and it basically takes your resume and turns it into a 1 to 3 hour narrative of your professional life. And we use it for everyone, regardless of if they're coming in as an intern or if they're coming in as an executive. And it is fantastic. It's helped us most importantly to avoid bad hires or people that weren't good fits, even though we were very excited about them. It's also given us a very good idea what someone's capabilities and also growth areas are. People who've gone through it with us have uniformly said, both the people who we've hired and not, that it was a really informative journey that they went on with the interviewers. That is always two people from our side that go in for the top grading interview. And it is, it's just this incredible sea change of how our hiring got so much better once we started going by this book. It's the way that I've described to other people is most things don't have an algorithmic solution. Most things there is nuance and subtlety and subjectivity. It turns out that 90% of hiring, or 100, maybe even 100% of hiring, emits itself to an algorithmic solution. The algorithm is the A method for hiring. You just follow it, and it works incredibly, incredibly well. We found it because we were talking with the A Capital people, and some of the people there were in HR at Google, and I think also at Spotify. And when they were building out the global culture and the global HR department, and I asked, when I run into people who are global experts in a domain, I usually ask them, hey, do you have a manual for like what you're an expert in? Is there like this thing that, this book that is a must read? And I sometimes get weird answers like, oh, I'm actually an expert in like doing a Zen garden. And there's this amazing book about it. But on this case, I was talking to the people at A Capital, and they gave me who the A method for hiring and said, like, this is the playbook for how we did large scale hiring. You should use this. And we did, and we haven't looked back since. It's amazing. It gets you the Brilliant. Team that you want to win with. Yep.
Wow. I love it.
Can't recommend it high enough.
Well, I just wrote that one down. Whothebook.com. Definitely going to be checking that out for our next series of hires here. One of the interesting things that I always find by doing these founder series episodes is kind of looking at like management style. So Will, what would you say Stuart's management style is? And then in Stuart, how would you classify Will's management style?
That's a hard question.
it's out of left field, but I think it always lends to the discussion. It gives a little bit more color.
I don't know. I mean, I'd say that we both fall into the pretty flexible category. Us both being from a tech background makes our management styles not that different. We try to be reasonable and understanding, and really it starts with hiring. If you hire the right group of people, there's not a whole lot of management that needs to get done. The main thing is making sure that the narrative and the discussion comes together in a way that you get the best out of what everyone has to offer. But in the end of the day, we're both engineers. We tend to be data driven. We like algorithmic approaches. Stuart definitely has way more experience than I do. And so I learn a lot from him. I went into this never having had any more than one or two direct reports. Stuart luckily had experience of running a 15 person team at JP Morgan before we met. And then the 10 person team that we were on at JP Morgan. So in that respect, he had 10 years of experience and two or three different jobs on me when it came to management. So for a lot of that, I look to him for just learning. And because of that, it's hard for me to really say like what his style is versus someone else. I've only ever had really good bosses. So Stu was one of them. And the ones that are two that I had before were quite good. So I'm reasonable and data driven, I guess.
Yeah, I think one thing, I think Will's right that, one being tech kind of changes your view of management, and you have a tendency to be a bit less, the interaction with your directs is a bit more direct to be, just because you're talking about engineering and things like that. And while I've led a lot of teams, like Will said, I've led teams since 2000 in building technology systems. It's also that they always have been tech teams, and then I've had some very good bosses too. I've had some terrible ones, but I've had some really good bosses. And I think one of the main things that Will and I share is that one of the main things that makes for good leadership is accountability. And that is, if you say you're going to fix something, it actually has to be fixed. If you say that. If you say you're going to work on something, it really needs to be worked on, and people need to have visibility into their needs being addressed and kind of feedback that they're being heard. I think one thing that was interesting for me working with Will, who, is almost 20 years my junior age-wise, Will, however, is much closer in age to most of the people we've hired. So that's actually been a benefit, because there are new thoughts about how workplaces operate when you're talking about like millennials and that generation. They have different expectations. I'm more old school, where, you know, you'd show up to a job and if your boss was nice to you, that's a perk, but you would never expect it. And I don't mean, but just, you know, but like, you know, actually a lot of the concepts around culture that I think really helped us survive the transition to remote that we recently did came out of the younger generation's kind of concern about these things. So I think that's one way we've benefited, is that while, yes, I have, you know, a great deal of experience with certain aspects of management, I've certainly never led a startup before, and startups are kind of young. They have a young feel anyway. But we also hired a number of people, you know, in their early 30s and some in their late 20s and even some people out of school. So I think that's a really fascinating thing. I think it's actually really important that startups, if they can, do hire older people, you know, whenever they can, and especially in engineering. The second oldest person after me is our lead engineer on Chainweb. And, you know, and you just get tremendous benefit. Startups are hard, and so you need every perspective you can get. But then it's important to realize that, like, you know, businesses shit on young people a lot, and they don't take their ideas seriously. And you know, so you want to, like, that. I think that's something that Will and I capture just due to due to who we are. And it's something it's been really exciting for me personally.
Wow, that is brilliantly insightful. I want to unpack one other thing that I thought of while I was listening to you, Stuart. You made the transition to remote, probably because of the coronavirus and stuff. Tell me how that transition was, and how do you feel about it now that you know, it's kind of solidified? Do you think it's here to stay, or would you really want to go back to working in an office? What are some of the pros and cons?
Well, you know, it's funny you'd ask me, because I was probably the most nervous person about it, or at least one of the most nervous people about going remote. But interestingly enough, we were planning on going remote anyway. You know, we did a kind of typical startup thing where we really burned hot to get to launch. And, you know, we got to launch, we nailed it, we made all our targets on time, launched our network on January 15th. But then at that point, we were like, okay, the network's live. Now we got to switch into sustainability mode. And one of those things was, we were going to go as remote as we could. We weren't going to go 100% remote, but the plan was to go down to, you know, only like 4 to 6 desks, and then everybody else would have hotel desks. And we enacted that plan March 1st of this year, and then come out looking like geniuses, like we, you know, predicted COVID and all this stuff. But in fact, it was just lucky timing. We were determined to go mainly remote, as mainly as a cost savings measure. And also just to be ready for anything, you know, in the sense that if our blockchain blew up globally, then we could, you know, it wouldn't be like this big weird culture thing to have people working in other countries. If our runway situation doesn't work out after a year, we can keep getting that burn down and be able to survive longer and longer.
So I wouldn't say it was luck. I would really say it was preparedness.
Absolutely. No, I mean, it was definitely a prepared thing. It's just that we weren't doing it for a pandemic. So when the pandemic showed up, it just,
you guys
meant
were well hedged.
We were well hedged. And what's more, it actually made cutting off that last bit of non-remote really easy. We just ended that lease right away and went to 100% remote. And I'll be honest, I think for our team and the size of our team, because remote has forced us to look at, not take culture for granted in terms of like water cooler culture for granted. You know, it's really forced us to think about how we want to like structure meetings and how we want to make sure that everybody's visible. We never had whole company all hands. Now we do once a week. And everybody really enjoys them. They're not like, you know, and I shouldn't say all hands. I mean, they're really stand-ups, you know, like everybody in the company says what they're working on, not just developers. And And you know, some people are like skeptical about that, but now that's become, I think, one of everybody's favorite things about working at Kadena is that once a week they get to hang out with a whole bunch of people and talk about working for the company that they love. So
it's invaluable.
Well, and it's really nice, obviously, when you're quarantined, you know, and these kinds of things. So, like, I think the fact that we were able to transition into remote comfortably has turned this thing into a big source of strength for everybody as we navigate this horrible time.
Yeah, makes a ton of awesome sense. Guys, this was a really, really insightful conversation. We've got just one last question for each of you. And the question is something that we pose to every single person that comes on the podcast. And it's as simple as this. If this was the first podcast that somebody was listening to about cryptocurrency or blockchain, what would you want them to know and why?
Look for what's real, not the hype. There's a lot of hype in the industry. There is real stuff going on in the industry too. Generally speaking, the stuff that's real can't be anywhere near as loud as the stuff that's fake. And because we're talking about digital money and it's in a regulatory gray zone, it means that there's a lot of fly by night, a lot of rather sketchy operations that take place. And like, those are the things, you know, if you had to know one thing, it's that, like, do your own research, like, don't follow the shows, like, really think about this stuff and think about it in a broader way than just like, oh, it's going to make 5x in the next, you know, 2 months, because if you follow that trend, you know, you might make it, but you probably are going to lose a fair bit. It's still emerging tech, but it's got a huge amount of potential. And Stu and I wouldn't have left, you know, the SEC and JP Morgan if we didn't think that the 2020s were going to be a massive sea change for what it is when it comes to money.
Wow. Well said. Stu, any last thoughts there?
I mean, my thought is just that one thing Kadena has always been is what I'll call a blockchain maximalist company. And what I mean by that is that blockchain means something despite what the incredible, you know, variety of what people have kind of abused the term to mean. And this it's really obvious on the enterprise side, but it's even pretty, there's even things on the public crypto side where these things get lost. And, you know, and what blockchain is a decentralized system that allows you to not have to trust a central party. And, you know, we all take that for granted when we're talking about blockchain, but the fact is that most proof of stake systems are centralized, if not all. I'm not going to say all, most. If they don't engineer, and not just engineer, but control their investor class very carefully, they become centralized just immediately. Most scaling solutions like Lightning Network start looking like interbank loans. Everything starts revolving around large liquidity centers. And I think one of the reasons why we like proof of work is that proof of work, you know, it's not perfect with respect to decentralization, but it does at least have the ability, and nobody is stopping it from being decentralized. And then likewise, even on the private blockchain side, you know, a lot of our competitors have gone away from architectures that are really as resilient as the blockchains, because blockchains also have this other feature. They can't be stopped. They're incredibly resilient. So if you have a decentralized system that is incredibly resilient, we should be able to move all sorts of things onto those platforms, you know, things like that today are centralized and really shouldn't be, whether that's like, you know, donation platforms, you know, you name it. Like, it's something where decentralization still has a lot to offer our society, and we're still really huge believers in it. And it's something that I don't talk about that often, because it, you know, people would be like, what? Well, yeah, of course, blockchain. But no, actually, a lot of things in blockchain in some ways are really moving away from that vision. And so that's what those are the projects I follow. Like Cosmos, to me, is an example of a proof of stake blockchain that really worked hard to not be centralized. And so, you know, I really respect what those guys did. And that's what I think about anyway.
Awesome. Well, those are some amazing nuggets, you know, big, chunky, golden nuggets of wisdom that you guys just imparted upon any person who's just perhaps tuning in for the first time. But guys, without further ado, we're going to sign off today. Thank you, Will. Thank you, Stuart, for talking to us about your career path from JP Morgan to being some titans of the crypto industry. And, you know, if people want to find out more about Kadena, where should we send them to? Are you guys pretty active on Twitter, Telegram, a good website?
Well, our website is Kadena.io. And of course, we have our Discord group. And you can get to all these things from our website. We have a newsletter. We are on Telegram, although we really like people to be on Discord. Twitter, we have a bunch of Medium posts. On Medium, you can sign up for our newsletter.
So, brilliant.
All that.
Sounds good. Thank you, gentlemen. And we'll hopefully talk to you guys soon.
Likewise. Thanks so much.
Thanks for having us.